Hi, Bob.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Today, I guess we're going to do something a little bit unusual. I mean, normally, you know, we focus on very current events. You know, sometimes it gets a little combative between you and me. But when I go into combat, I like to have ammunition in the form of being actually conversant in current events. And I can't say that I especially am at the moment, because I've spent this summer communing with the divine. So conveniently, somebody on our staff
somehow.
What's that?
It sounds like a setup somehow.
No.
But okay, I'll be your stooge. It's okay.
It really is a setup just to avoid me having to betray my ignorance very recent events, because I'm not that well versed. But as it happens, a valued staff member of Blogging Heads came to the rescue a couple of weeks ago with this idea that you and I would get together around the anniversary of 9/11. And just do a kind of retrospective thing, a kind of taking stock, where we stand in the war on terror, what's unfolded since 9/11. And we were originally going to take this before 9/11, like a real media outfit would do.
Yeah.
But then we realized we're like alternative media, so we should be late to the party.
Yeah, and I think probably the number of people who were bummed out to find out that we didn't do it before is probably small.
I don't know. I've sensed a little, there's something in the mood of America I sense that I traced to our not having shown up.
Better than I do, but okay.
There's a little disappointment out there.
Yeah.
So let's take stock.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you have to say about the current situation?
Well, you know, there's the start with the old cliche at this point, which is that if you had asked 500 experts after September 11th whether we would go this long without an attack, 500 of them would have said no. And in fact, that's not a conditional. That's in fact true. I mean, no one believed we would go this long without an attack. And I remember during the Bush years, one heard a lot from very respectable people that Bush's policies were infinitely increasing the number of terrorists and making an attack more likely. Now, I don't know whether those same people still believe that that's true, but I would just say it's not obvious from the evidence that that turned out to be true.
Well, no, I guess it depends on your time frame. I mean, how long do you think it takes chickens to come home to roost?
I don't know. But I'm just saying, I think that, you know, I think everybody is probably... Everybody who is looking at this honestly would say it's either been pretty remarkable or we vastly overestimated their capacity to pull these things off.
Yeah, I remember a friend of mine, Steve Lagerfeld, whom you may know, he's editor of the Wilson Quarterly.
Sure.
It was not long after 9/11, was the only unconcerned person I ran into. And he just said, you are vastly overestimating the competence of these guys.
Yeah.
They did put together one great attack. I think this was right after the Richard Reid aborted shoe bombing. And he did not look like a picture of competence, I must say.
No.
And Steve used him as an example and said, you know, by and large, don't be afraid.
Well,
but he was alone. I certainly expected that we would...
Well, and here's a metaphysical... I mean, here's an interesting question for you. So for years, I would say, none of us would even dare say this, right? Because then the next day there'd be some... And let alone would the government say anything like that, because the next day something terrible would happen.
Right.
Are we getting to the point where it's been so long that people could say this and they don't go around looking for wood to knock on and all the other, you know, things to try to ward off evil spirits?
I think we are. I think also, I mean, let's face it, if you had a minor, if you lost 100 people next year and you said, okay, you know, a decade out, we've lost 100 people, that would still be way better than the average expert would have predicted, I think, don't you, right after 9/11?
Yeah. Now, of course, as we speak, to jump to current events slightly, there are all kinds of raids being conducted in New York City at suspected or allegedly suspected plotters of some potentially Madrid-style, you know, subway bombing. So,
is this like late-breaking news I just got?
Well, only in the last couple of days. I mean, it started breaking yesterday.
For me these days.
I mean, I can imagine when your subject is God that, you know, a couple of days is pretty late breaking.
All of this seems pretty small by comparison.
I understand.
With God.
I do understand. Yeah. But anyway, so, you know, it's not like there aren't people, at least theoretically, trying to do stuff and capable of doing stuff. So.
Oh, no, it's not. And the other thing I'd say is, look, you know, we have, in the course of trying to combat the terrorist threat, gotten a bunch of people killed. Most of them are not Americans, but a non-trivial number were American soldiers, and then a lot of Iraqis, and so on. So it's not as if, from God's point of view, you might say, this has been an unequivocal success.
Well, I would dare say in these kinds of affairs there's no such thing as an unequivocal success, but I certainly take your point.
Yeah.
And, you know, now, too, we are doing a lot of bombing and killing, you know, some fair percentage of civilians in the process, whether with drones or with airstrikes, all in the name of this effort, which brings me to, you know, one of the potentially large questions that we could deal with, which is, have we moved in our foreign policy away from a 9/11-centric approach? And I think what is either ironic or utterly predictable is that we really haven't. There was a quite good and I think acutely perceptive story in the Washington Post the other day which backs up things that I've heard from administration officials, which said that, you know, at the end of the day, President Obama's number one preoccupation is preventing another terrorist attack and preventing nuclear weapons from getting in the hands of terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can almost understand his entire foreign policy in that way. That explains his, you know, everything revolves around that. His policy toward Russia is designed to get Russian pressure on Iran so that Iran won't build a nuclear weapon, so that Iran's nuclear weapons won't wind up in the hands of terrorists, etc. And you know, and you can see that across a broad front, which would suggest that, on that score at least, there's sort of a remarkable continuity. I guess it's not remarkable. I think, as I say, it's probably a predictable continuity between actually Clinton, Bush, and Obama in focusing on this issue, but certainly Bush and Obama.
Well, in part because of the obvious political incentive. It's bad news for you if you're president and you're the first president on whose watch there's been a terrorist attack since 9/11.
You don't even have to be that cynical about it. You just might, as president, you probably feel like, what am I in this office for other than to, you know,
right.
That's more important than preventing that from happening, which is why, you know, which is why the Bush administration responded the way it did on a lot of fronts, some of which people were very upset about. You know, it's kind of the 1% approach, right, in a way. But I think it's interesting how the 9/11 effect, even if a lot of Americans have sort of stopped worrying, as we were saying, is still fundamental in shaping the overall thrust of our foreign policy. And I guess, I've been saying this for some time. I said it about the Bush administration, too. I think that's probably unfortunate because I think we have to, of course, be worried about this threat. But I'm not happy about building our entire foreign policy around it.
Yeah. Well, what do you think should be the? I mean, I actually think, you know, threats from for a long time have put more emphasis on threats from non-state actors than you have, maybe. So It's not obvious to me what the alternative focus is in terms of national defense. I don't mean foreign policy. Foreign policy covers a lot of stuff, including non-military things. But in terms of national defense, what do you think should be getting the focus that's not?
Well, that's a really key question, and I think that where we are now is it's hard for anybody to understand or explain what our national interests are beyond preventing some terrorist from blowing up a nuclear weapon in one of our cities, which means that we have sort of either forgotten or decided are no longer relevant what had been perceived as a very broad set of interests having to do with world order, having to do with protecting allies against potential adversaries, maintaining a balance of forces that sort of favors our approach to the world, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm beginning to wonder that the consensus behind that approach may be dissipating. I mean, as I look out at the world, I see lots of potential problems. I see, and I think you don't agree with me about these problems. But I find worrying Russian foreign policy. I find China's increasing power something that I think is going to be an issue for us in the years to come. By the way, I'm at least backed up on this by the intelligence community, which just released one of its assessments, you know, expressing some concern in the future about Russia and China. I do worry about Iran acquiring nuclear weapon for the regional impact of that, not so much because they're going to hand it off to a terrorist. So, I mean, I do think that we live in a complicated world. I think a lot of the things we took for granted about the benefits of our predominance in the world, as that predominance begins to fade, I worry about some of the consequences of that. But okay. I don't think I have a lot of I don't think I have a large pool of opinion on my side on this issue. I mean, even conservatives are more worried. You know, they would focus more on the terrorism aspect and on, you know.
Well, what specifically are you worried about China doing, for example?
Behaving like a normal rising power. I mean, I think that...
And what would that do to America? What would they do to America as a result of
that?
Well,
they wouldn't necessarily do anything to America, but they would want to reduce significantly American influence in their part of the world, which would have an impact on the nations in that part of the world that tend to look to us for their protection, and will have an impact on how our allies deal with China and how our allies look at us. I mean, there is, you know, and ultimately, China would like to be the predominant power in that part of the world. And then, you know, I could extrapolate what happens after it becomes the predominant power.
Yeah, that's what I'd like, because it's sounding pretty abstract so far. I'm not sensing
it. It is abstract.
So far, I haven't heard anything I'm going to lose sleep over.
You shouldn't lose sleep over it in the near term, and I'm not even suggesting that you do. I mean, I don't even think probably, don't really think we're going to have a war with Taiwan anytime soon either, which is the obvious tripwire for a conflict.
That I am concerned about a little, yeah. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's right to be somewhat concerned about that, although I don't think it's in the offing any minute particularly. But you know, I will not feel better about the world in some, you know, in both in a broad sense and in specific sense, where China has effectively become the hegemon of East Asia. I mean, that can affect all kinds of things from...
Okay, I'd still like to hear one, though. What? What would it do to us?
Well, for one thing, we take for granted, as a friend of mine, Dan Blumenthal, points out, the fact that there's been no, you know, major war in that region for a long time. I think one of the reasons there's been no major war in that region for a long time is because of the United States' preponderance of power.
Well, right, but...
So, yes, you could see, if China is getting stronger, America's getting weaker, you could see Japan deciding that it can no longer rely on American guarantees, has to develop its own nuclear program, has to develop its own nuclear weapons, has to develop its own military, which is quite substantial to begin with. And you could begin to see tensions in between Japan and China, which could conceivably lead to war, as they have many times in the past. I mean, that's an ancient rivalry, which has frequently produced warfare. So that would be a pretty big deal, you know. I don't know if I can explain to you how it would affect anyone in Iowa the next day, but I don't know how anybody could have explained why anyone should care about what Japan was doing in China in the 1930s either.
I'd like to not see a war between Japan and China.
Yeah.
That does seem distant indeed, especially given that, and I think you'll agree that by and large, China shows no interest in belligerence per se. China pursues its interests in a very calculating fashion, but I think you'll agree that, by and large, it would rather pursue these largely economic interests peacefully.
I think we are about to reprise an argument we've had at least once in the past, but let me just say this, and you know, you can come back at this if you want to. I don't believe the Chinese, like any normal power, are only concerned about their economic interests. I think that's not the way nations behave. I think nations mm-hmm. are interested in all kinds of things, including honor, their sense of self, their sense of what justice is, their sense of how the international system should treat them and how they should operate within that international system. If you only try to explain national behavior throughout history in terms of economics, I think you'd miss a lot of what was going on.
Well, and I think in that regard, maybe you'll agree with this, I think there's a tendency, because we still kind of stereotype, some people call China totalitarian, which I think is absurd. It is authoritarian, and any event, because we have it vaguely in the kind of, you know, that kind of dictator part of our mind, I think people don't appreciate the fact that its government actually is responsive to public opinion in many ways, and I think there is a threat. I think nationalist fervor at the popular level is something that we cannot count on the Chinese government to be able to resist.
Well,
that I worry about.
This will reprise another conversation that we've had earlier. But what I think is, I think you've missed the whole boat here, Bob, because if you've been reading Tom Friedman, you know that the Chinese actually have a superior form of government to ours. Did you miss that while you were conversing?
That must be a column I didn't read.
Oh, yeah, you have to go take a look at one of Tom's recent columns. He talked about how because the Republicans are obstructing on health care, and therefore we really would be better off with a kind of autocratic system where a government could get things done. Gosh darn it.
Yeah. Well, they do have an edge in that department.
They do, in some
respects. I don't recommend emulating them, but they do have an edge in the get things done department, I think.
Yeah.
Let's jump right to a very contemporary issue by way of 9/11, which is Afghanistan.
Yeah.
What would you say the purpose of the war in Afghanistan was when we launched it?
Well, the purpose when we launched it, I always felt, was to... You had to remove the Taliban from power, since the Taliban was aside from its other many virtues, was playing willing host to Al-Qaeda, which was therefore able to use Afghanistan as a base from which to launch attacks like September 11th, right?
I don't agree with that. I mean, strictly speaking, all you had to do from an American point of view was get the Taliban to quit providing a base.
Well, it's not clear to me how you were going to do that. I mean, it wasn't as if the Clinton administration hadn't attempted to address this issue. But in any case, you asked me what the reason for the war was, and that's probably what the reason for the war was,
right? So the idea was you did have to remove the Taliban.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
Okay, so we kind of did that.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that our security is, on balance, that the war in Afghanistan has probably had a negative impact on our national security, in the sense that I guess you'll agree that the war has exerted a destabilizing effect on Pakistan, made it more likely, however likely that may or may not be, made it somewhat more likely that nuclear weapons, namely Pakistan's, could wind up in the hands of our enemies, of terrorists, and that's quite a price to pay. Meanwhile, we of course didn't get Bin Laden and bring him to justice or anything like that.
Well, I don't agree with the first point, though. I don't know why. I think that Pakistan's instability is homegrown. I don't think it's a result of our intervention in Afghanistan.
Well, there's a certain amount of actual displacement, though, of elements, right?
Yeah, although it's a complicated story, since the Pakistani, intelligence services were supporting those elements in the first place, right? I mean, Pakistan's government has had a pretty complicated relationship, let's say, with the very kinds of people that we're trying to get rid of. And it's only recently that it appears that the Pakistani government, and particularly its military, has been willing to crack down on people that it used to sort of be helpful with, right? So I think that Pakistan was a problem in and of itself. I actually think that if we were able to stabilize Afghanistan, it would have a beneficial effect on Pakistan and would, in fact, be a net positive from where we were, say, 10 years ago. Where we were headed 10 years ago, anyway.
Uh-huh. And so you think, so now the two goals in Afghanistan are continue to keep the Taliban out and in the process of securing peace in Afghanistan, you would help stabilize Pakistan.
Yeah, and obviously the goal in Afghanistan is to try to create a stable enough situation that can be self-sustaining ultimately. And that's obviously the difficulty. It's the same kind of difficulty that we faced and continue to face in Iraq. But the exit strategy is an Afghan government that is both willing, able to prevent the return of the Taliban and to prevent its territory from being used by Al-Qaeda, just the way, or groups like Al-Qaeda, just the way that's been our goal in Iraq as well.
Doesn't that seem like an extremely remote goal at this point?
Well, I'm not sure.
I mean, you've got a corrupt government in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And Afghanistan, unlike Iraq, has no real history of effective centralized governance. Right,
but I think that I'm not persuaded that we can't make progress in that direction. I think that the recent election is obviously unfortunate, and in fact, what to do about the recent election is an interesting question. But look, I you're not saying this necessarily, but I have to laugh when people say, boy, Iraq was easy, Afghanistan is hard. I mean, wasn't the view circa December 2006.
I'm saying on theoretical grounds, you would say Iraq should be easier than Afghanistan, and Iraq was a nightmare and is not over yet.
Only in retrospect would I say that. And at the time, it seemed really impossible because you had things operating in Iraq that aren't operating in Afghanistan, like a potential for a full-blown, you know, civil war and even genocide. So that's not particularly one of the problems in Afghanistan, although there are definitely tribal disputes. But, no, I think that it's doable. And, more to the point, because I don't think it matters what I think, I think people who are close to Afghanistan, our military commander in Afghanistan, our military chain of command, which was not true, which is quite divided on Iraq, as I watch Mullen testify, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I think our military is pretty united up and down the chain that this is doable if the administration and the American people are willing to support what needs to be done, which is a lengthy stay. I mean, there's no question about
it. It's a lengthy and probably growing presence. I mean,
Definitely a growing presence.
Yeah, well, your brother, as some people may or may not know, is Frederick, credited by many as the architect of the surge strategy in Iraq, right?
Yeah.
And I saw some math he did on how many troops you would need, according to counterinsurgency doctrine, to stabilize Afghanistan. And I've actually heard numbers higher than this. This is, I think, maybe the lowest number. But it was the number of troops you need is, I don't know, it was 300,000, 400,000 or something.
But that was including Afghan troops.
Of course, but right now there's virtually zero effective Afghanistan troops.
No, that's not true.
Well, come on, tens of thousands, low tens of thousands. How many effective Afghanistan troops are there, Bob?
I won't claim expertise on how many exactly, but here's what I'll agree with you about. There needs to be a lot more Afghan troops. There needs to probably be a couple hundred thousand more Afghan troops, and it's going to take time to train them up to be able to do that job. That's right.
And even so, you'll see more and more American troops.
You have to see more American troops, partly because the training activity, as it's been developed, the kind of training activity that works means American soldiers partnering with Afghan forces in the field. That's what was so effective in Iraq, and that's what's going to have to happen in Afghanistan. And that's what's wrong with Senator Levin's proposal, which is really just a way of trying to avoid sending more troops in, which is let's train up the Afghan forces and not have an increase in U.S. troops. As Mullen pointed out, it just doesn't work that way.
You know, there's also a broader, this will actually take us back to 9/11, there's a broader kind of theoretical question of, to say we need to deny a country, to deny terrorists access to a country, that we need to deny them a host country, of course, presupposes something about what you need to do, what you need to have to do effective terrorism, right?
Yeah.
The idea is, You need this big stretch of turf where nobody bothers you. Maybe you even need the instruments of state to help you out, although Afghanistan is
probably
far
not
from the most powerful state you could have acting on your behalf,
yeah,
of course. There's kind of two questions. First of all, there's the is that true question, and I think there's always been a tendency of people in your camp to emphasize state support. And frankly, I think this mindset, not on your part necessarily, but this mindset generally helped get us into Iraq, because as soon as 9/11 happened, there were people who were just unable to conceive of a terrorist attack like that happening without state support. There had to be a state. You know, it wasn't hosting the obvious host in Afghanistan. That's how we first started thinking about going into Iraq.
There's two ways of looking at what the problem is, and I would say that, you know, I think most people would agree that the real problem is our failed states, not state sponsors at the moment, you know.
Well, okay.
And failed states are now, so that's why Afghanistan is a problem.
Well, right. And the question is, so suppose at this massive cost in blood and treasure, you finally secure Afghanistan. Well, as long as you've got Somalias popping up all over the place, what have you really accomplished? You know,
Bob, I mean, I think we've already, look, I mean, we started off this conversation by talking about a threat that appears certainly not to have become as great as people worried it was going to become and may even have diminished. And surely our actions in Afghanistan have had some part in diminishing that threat, right?
Oh, I don't accept that.
Oh, okay.
Well, I will say this, that at the very beginning in Afghanistan, there was a substantial amount of, like, intelligence resources that we recovered in Afghanistan, I think, right? I mean, Al-Qaeda had bases there. They had computers and stuff. I think we found a lot of stuff out that was helpful in the early going. Now, beyond that, I'm not saying it hasn't been effective. It's just not clear to me what the benefit has been, and you can maybe enlighten me here, and I can definitely see some downside. But what have the benefits been beyond that?
Well, I would say in both Iraq and Afghanistan, we've killed a lot of potential terrorists, not potential, but, you know, practicing terrorists who, I mean, it sounds trite, but who, if they were not fighting us in Iraq and Afghanistan, would be fighting us somewhere else. I just think that's
actually
true.
I think that's worse than trite. It's wrong, but go ahead.
Well, wrong is better than trite, I think, usually.
Wrong is worse than trite. Trite things are true. I would be willing to base a foreign policy on trite, true things.
Okay. I don't know why you're so sure that that's not true, Bob.
Well, I just think, look.
I mean, this used to be the big argument. Back in 2007 or 2006 or 2008, this is what I was talking about before. The theory was that because of what we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, we were creating thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of new terrorists, you know? And if that's true, I just wonder where are they? Because it doesn't seem obvious to me that that is true.
Do you actually, I mean...
No, I don't know what the count is out there right now.
Well, moreover, do you think any of these terrorists we were killing in Iraq, who definitely were terrorists in the sense of blowing up Iraqi civilians, which, by the way, is not something they were doing before we started the war, but how many of them... do you think before the war were actually a threat to America?
Well, we're talking about,
or even during the war,
we're talking
but certainly
about a
before
lot of
the
foreign terrorists who came into Iraq for the purpose of fighting the Americans, and who were then told that after Iraq was a lost cause, they ought to now go to Afghanistan and fight the Americans. And if you didn't have Iraq and Afghanistan, they would be going somewhere else to fight the Americans, like America. I mean, I think that that's. I don't think that's implausible.
I mean, your model just seems to me to presuppose this fixed population of terrorists.
No,
you
not
know?
A fixed population, but I'm not sure that we're not, you know, killing enough to make a difference. You know, and you just, Bob, your basic presumption is that everything we are doing is a total negative. That it only is producing terrorists. It's not ridding us of any terrorists.
I just mentioned the positive. I just said the initial invasion of Afghanistan recovered valuable intelligence resources.
Sorry?
I just cited something that was positive about the initial invasion of Afghanistan.
Well,
which was
right. Since we broke up the whatever Al-Qaeda base there was, I mean, your basic view is that everything we've been doing has been not even a net negative, but a total negative. And I just don't think that's plausible. I mean, I don't know exactly where the balance falls out, and I'm not saying there haven't been any negative consequences, unlike you, who insist on saying there are no positive consequences.
I wouldn't say that. I just, when you start saying, well, look at all the terrorists we've killed, let's face it, terrorists multiply, can multiply. I think we have done some things to multiply them and to redirect their focus on us in some cases.
Well, I'm willing to accept that as a theoretical postulate, but as a practical matter, I'm not seeing it.
Well, what came to be called Al-Qaeda in Iraq and provided a number of these terrorists that you're so happy we killed...
Well, some of them were homegrown...
Prior to the war...
Right. I agree.
Prior to the war, it did have some anti-American animus and had even done a thing or two, but it was largely focused against the Jordanian government.
I agree that, I mean, some of the terrorists that we killed in Iraq were terrorists that we created in Iraq. I agree with
that.
Okay. The only question is, was there anybody else out there that we killed that was already was already a terrorist and was already, you know, hoping to fight the Americans somewhere and was, unfortunately for him, sent to Iraq to fight them? You know, I mean, look, since neither of us have any of these fingers numbers at our fingertips, and I'm not sure even, you know, the biggest terrorist expert in the world knows exactly what the balance is. I'm just saying it seems to me as a purely sort of observational matter that, you know, we both agree at the beginning of this conversation that the terrorist threat seems to have diminished.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say there's been refreshingly little terrorism on American soil.
Well, there hasn't even been that much terrorism on other soil either.
Well, there has been what we describe as terrorism in the war zones that we created by invading countries.
Right.
There have been a lot of civilians killed
right.
by bombs.
Right.
And that's not nothing. And, I mean, by your own account, you know, those are, well, you certainly think those are terrorists who would have been killing civilians
not
somewhere
necessarily.
If not there.
I mean, no, I agree with you. It's a mixed picture. I agree.
So neither of us, refreshingly, neither of us really professes to know for sure why there has been less terrorism than people had expected.
But I'll tell you what, if this continues...
Yeah.
As someone who, like you, reads a lot of history, I predict that at some point some historian will write, well, maybe it worked. You know?
Oh, I suspect you've already gotten that book half written.
I haven't got that book half written. I'm not anywhere now. I'm still talking about Woodrow Wilson, you know, so I'm a bit ways off, you know.
Here's another book that may be written,
yeah.
Okay? The book that may be written after an act of nuclear terrorism in 5 or 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, in which case it didn't work.
It not only didn't work, the book that may be written is that we focused obsessively on preventing terrorism in the short run, and you and I agree that presidents, including both Bush and Obama, have been quite focused on this. We focused obsessively on preventing it in the short run in ways that actually retarded progress on preventing it in the long run. And I have my ideas on what kind of progress that would be.
Yeah.
But I do think, especially during the Bush administration, but I think in general, there has not been nearly enough attention to doing systematic things to diminish the threat of terrorism in the long run, including, of course, the proliferation of nuclear and biological weapons.
Okay. Well, now let's move from the profound to the petty, okay?
Okay.
Have you noticed that in all of this you're not saying, thank God we have Barack Obama in the White House because now he's changed everything and is doing things the right way, just the way you think they should be done?
Did I forget to say
you
that?
You did. Maybe that was in the talking points and you just skipped over it. I don't know.
I thank God that we have Barack Obama and not George Bush. He's not doing everything exactly as I would like,
yeah.
But...
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's likely, for instance, right, Bob, that he's probably going to send some additional troops to Afghanistan. I mean, whether he goes for, you know, McChrystal laid out the Goldilocks option for him. I hope he actually goes for the high option. You probably hope he goes for not even the low option, but he's going to go for one of those options, right? So he's going to increase troops in Afghanistan.
Probably.
He's going to continue to sustain, at least for the time being, our presence in Iraq. And on now, we haven't talked about Iran, but we can talk a little bit about Iran if you'd like to.
Yeah, let's do.
Having a hard time seeing an enormous shift in policy at this point. Because what I see is that we're going to send Bill Burns to another conference of Europeans with Iranians following the one that he did with the Bush administration, at which the five powers plus one are going to say to Iran, you really need to stop enrichment.
Yeah.
And that just strikes me as... And then, if I understand the administration's strategy, which I'm not sure that may be an overstatement, they're going to then press for very strong sanctions against Iran. Now,
yeah.
I actually think this is the right thing to do, but I would say it's somewhat less than revolutionary.
So you're saying in Iran specifically there's been a lot of continuity with Bush's foreign policy?
Yeah, and too much in a way, because we had this we had this stolen election and we have a major ferment in Iran, which was not apparent anyway during the Bush years, which the Obama administration is unfortunately, apparently, sort of attempting to ignore. And I don't see how it's factoring into their policy at this moment. But yes, otherwise I would say there's definitely broad continuity.
Well, I think there, I was going to say, if you were talking about continuity broadly, that I think one reason for that is that, as is commonly said, the Bush administration had drifted in the later years, I don't know if you buy this or not,
yeah.
But it's common to say, I think it's true, had drifted toward realism, became a transition to
Obama. I was with you
Obama.
Until you said realism, but I'll let it pass, okay?
What's that?
I was with you until you used the word realism, but I'm going to let it pass.
I don't know. You would agree, I think, that...
I don't think realism has anything to do with negotiating or not negotiating. I really don't. It's a practical question.
Well, no, the early Bush, under the influence of people I might call neoconservatives,
Wrongly, I would say, by the way. But
well, maybe.
I don't know who you're talking about in the administration, but okay.
Dick Cheney,
the famous realist? I mean, the famous neoconservative?
Paul Wolfowitz?
You really think Paul Wolfowitz was shaping a RAND policy? I don't.
No. I'm just saying, philosophically, you would expect to emanate from that kind of influence a greater likelihood of saying to Iran now, no more negotiations, given the fact that you rigged that election and then beat the people who protested and so on.
No, I would say no more negotiations for a different reason, which is that they're not. There's no chance that they're going to have any positive effect. I mean, that's realistic, in my view. The Iranians are not going to negotiate away their nuclear program, right?
But I thought you said you favored. Did you not say you thought?
I have no problem with negotiations, but I don't care one way or the other. I don't think it's going to make any difference. What I favor.
You favor negotiations so that they will conspicuously fail.
I favored going through the process of demonstrating to, I don't know, whoever's willing to be demonstrated, the Iranians are not actually interested in talking about this issue, so that you can then move to sanctions, yes.
And then what? Because you don't think sanctions is going to stop them, do you?
Actually, you see, my attitude towards sanctions has changed because of the election. I mean, if you'd asked me, you know, a year ago, I would have said sanctions. Well, I still believe sanctions are not necessarily going to affect whether they go for a nuclear weapon or not. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think that I'm wondering whether the effect of sanctions could actually be to produce a shuffling in that government, which could actually, in the end, have a positive effect on their policies. But that's what I'm looking at. I don't think sanctions are going to prevent them from going ahead with their program. But in the present unstable situation of the Iranian government, I wonder whether sanctions can have that a kind of revolutionary impact.
Well, but don't sanctions sometimes provide the sense of persecution
but
from
not
the
in
outside?
This case.
That is
a- not in this case, Bob. And I've been talking to some very smart Iranian scholars who have. Generally, you know, before this, we're of the opinion that you need to talk to the Iranian government and et cetera, who now believe that the Iranian people are so angry at their government that they're not going to now all of a sudden decide that they like Khamenei and Ahmadinejad because the world has imposed sanctions on them. So I'm not worried that this is going to solidify support for Ahmadinejad or Khamenei.
That sounds like a convenient analysis. I mean,
you shouldn't take my word for it.
Iranians, and Ahmad Chalabi was a real Iraqi.
If every one of our conversations I have to talk about Ahmad Chalabi, I was not in favor of supporting Ahmad Chalabi, okay? So just, you know,
okay,
leave the playbook
the point
at home.
Is,
but I would
we,
say
we,
that... If, I would say talk, there are a lot of Iranian scholars worth talking to about this issue right now.
Yeah.
People who've been, you know, advising the Clinton. I mean, advising the Obama administration.
Look, I would love for sanctions to work in either sense.
Yeah.
You know, either to stop the development of the nuke or to lead to a change of government.
Yeah. I think I'm more encouraged than I ever have been over the past decade, given what's been going on in Iran.
Yeah, well, I don't profess to know, to have, like, the inside story. My only point in bringing up Chalabi was you can always get an expert from the country you're talking about
Chalabi
to say any given thing.
Okay, fair enough. If there was only one Iranian who was saying this. But anyway, off camera, I'll tell you who to talk
to. We'll swap data, and I will vouch or not. So failing that, what do you think is going to happen? Let's suppose that doesn't happen and they're on the brink of the bomb. Do you think we'll see military intervention?
I've been told by a fairly, I would say, well-placed official in the administration that I would be wrong to completely rule out that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what, I think it would be, it's going to be a disaster if the Israelis do it.
Speaking as an American, I'm not sure it's going to be too wonderful if the Americans do
it. No, fair enough, but I'm just, anyway, I don't know.
I mean, what's the difference? What is really the difference?
The Israelis, as is so often the case, can only sort of take step one. They can't sort of take steps two and three. And our capacities are so much greater than theirs.
Our military capacity.
Yes, our ability to get through and take out what needs to be taken out. They have very limited capacity.
Oh, yeah, we have greater military resources.
Yeah.
We would do it more effectively.
Yeah.
But in terms of the blowback and the downside to American security, why is it better for America to do it?
Well, we'll pay the same price anyway. I mean, look, what happens if the Israelis do it? I mean, we don't need to get into this conversation for very long, but if the Israelis do it, the Iranian response is going to be to treat the situation as if we did it anyway, right? So that would be their game. They would, you know, close the straits. They would undertake whatever troublemaking they could undertake around the world. And so we would then be faced with the choice of, you know, going to war with Iran ourselves or letting them do whatever they're going to do. So, that, I mean, at the end of the day, there's no escaping our role in this. It would be nice to have the Israelis be, I don't know if deus ex machina is the appropriate way to talk about the state of Israel, but it would be nice for them to sort of to think that they could solve this problem for us, but I don't think they can.
Well, so then you're not saying what I thought you were saying, is that it would be much worse for Israel to do it. You only mean in a military sense it would be worse for Israel to do it. I mean, you're saying
it would be worse for Israel to do it because it would carry all the... For Israel to do it is one thing. For the United States to do it, and I would hope, and now we're going to get into, I mean, I don't even want to go in this direction, but I would hope with some degree of international support, that could be a different kettle of fish. Then you're going to say, would the Europeans ever support us doing that? You know, I don't know.
No, I think not. And what vital American security objective would be achieved by this?
Well, I'm not indifferent to the idea of the Iranians having a nuclear weapon in a part of the world where we have demonstrated interests that we are, committed to protecting. I mean, I would say that, you know, with Iran with a nuclear weapon, I do worry about the nature of their government. Maybe you don't. I worry more about Iran having a nuclear weapon than North Korea having a nuclear weapon, because North Korea's got, you know, they've got pretty limited capacities.
Actually, I'm not sure I do. I think North Korea would be more likely to give nukes to a terrorist just for the money.
No, that's true. But I would say that for Iran, it's got geostrategic implications as well. It has to do with how they relate to the rest of the region. And, of course, then we go down the whole, potentially dangerous route of what happens if all the neighboring countries who are fearful of Iran decide that they need nuclear weapons, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, wouldn't you find that to be... Aren't you in favor of non-proliferation?
Well, yeah,
opposed,
but here we
opposed,
get it...
As opposed to rampant proliferation?
Here we get at one problem I have with bombing Iran is, you know, I have been,
hey, I have problems with bombing Iran, too. Don't get me wrong.
But I have been agitating for a long time, way before 9/11, for getting serious about an actual nuclear non-proliferation regime with actual teeth, much more than the nuclear non-proliferation treaty has, and so on. We haven't really gotten very serious about that. I think it's the most important thing we could probably do, and more than that, we have not even articulated a general set of principles according to which it is unacceptable for Iran to have a bomb, but it's okay for all our friends to have a bomb, even if they're outside of the non-proliferation regime.
Well, I mean, the non-proliferation regime from the very beginning was a total double standard with no sense of justice that I think your friend God would ever recognize, okay? I mean, the countries that had them, and then decided that nobody else should have them. Well, where was the fairness in that? There's no fair. The only thing that's fair is if everybody gets a nuclear weapon or no one has a nuclear weapon, right? Those are the only two fair options. Everything else is unfair, arbitrary, dependent on who's...
Well, life is unfair.
No, but I mean, it's arbitrary, and it depends on who's got the power in the international system.
Look, you can say that about the creation of the United Nations itself. The Security Council has disproportionate power.
Right.
In the real world, powerful people always have more powerful than power than less
right,
powerful
and that
people.
Explains
and institutions
why,
reflect that.
That explains why the countries we like get to have nuclear weapons.
No, but Bob, you're missing the point.
Oh, sorry.
You're right that this logic was built into the NPT,
yeah.
But we have since gone on to say that if you ignore the NPT or violate the NPT but get a nuclear weapon, it's okay if you're our friend, like Israel or India, but it's not okay if you're our enemy, like Iran.
Right.
That is not a generally applicable principle. And you can understand how in Iran they kind of scratch their heads and say, why just us?
Yeah, I understand. I think I did understand the point. But the point is, at the end of the day, the only thing you can say is because we think it would be too dangerous for you to have the bomb, and we don't want you to have the bomb. This is the problem when you use try to use international law to solve geopolitical and geostrategic problems. International law is supposed to treat everybody equally, but we don't treat everybody equally, and we never have, and I would venture to guess we never will.
Well, even American law does not, in effect, treat everyone equally, because if you can afford a high-priced lawyer, you'll do better than an accused criminal who can't.
Right, and the international...
But are you saying for that reason we should abandon the legal structure of America, Bob?
Well, I don't think so, no. But
well, that's the analogous conclusion.
I mean, there's
What's the difference? What's the difference?
Because the international system is one of is basically one of anarchy, as the realists will tell you.
So was America's at one point, you know?
State-level
government took time to evolve as well, but you agree that its having evolved is a good thing. So why are you against its evolution in the realm of international law?
I don't think it's possible in any conceivable time frame. And so the problem is, what do you do? Let's assume that it's possible to get there eventually. Okay, I'm not sure it is, but I'll grant you that for the sake of argument. You still have to get through the next 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, or 100 years, or 200 years before you get there. And if you are going, you know, you can be in a very difficult position if you try to live by an international legal system that is not yet operational, and therefore are unable to deal with immediate threats that you're confronting. I mean, you know, if Hitler goes into France and then you want to bring him up to the, if there's the United Nations, you bring him up to the United Nations, it's not going to have any effect, so you actually have to go fight. I mean, you have real problems in real time that international law can't solve.
Well, I wouldn't compare Iran having a nuclear bomb to Hitler invading a country.
No, I'm just saying, that's the problem.
Especially since its having a nuclear bomb does not distinguish it from any of the countries I just listed.
I agree, except that we think that they are a dangerous group of people and that the other guys are not. I'm not worried about what India is going to do with its nuclear bomb.
Yeah, but do you appreciate the fact that there are people on the other side of the fence
in the
Arab world and Iran who actually think Israel is dangerous?
Do you appreciate
that from their point of view, that's not an entirely crazy thing, whether they're right or wrong?
It wouldn't even matter whether they were right or wrong. I understand that they would feel that way and that our sense of what the right thing to do is not the same as their sense of what the right thing to do is. So then now I think we are reprising another conversation we've had in the past. What do you do then? If you can't, in fact, impose a universal principle that everyone is going to live with, and you're left with this imperfect situation where we are now, what do you do when we think that Iran shouldn't have a nuclear weapon, and they say, then, well, you know, why do you have nuclear weapons? What's your answer? What do you do, throw up your hands at that point? I mean, I don't understand. At that point, why are we even having negotiations with them? If they have a right to it, we shouldn't even be trying to talk them out of it. On what basis? What's the justification for us talking them out of it?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a couple of answers. First of all, I think, unlike you, we could be well on the road to an effective non-proliferation regime if we had not screwed up time and again over the last couple of decades. And by the way, when you're trying to nurture the evolution of a normative and legal system like this, you have to nurture precedent. You have to respect precedent. And in the case of Iraq, let's don't get into this in a big way, but in the case of Iraq, we had Iraq accepting the presence of intrusive inspections, and that was going to be a valuable precedent in this very realm, and then we said, no, that's not enough. We're going to invade you anyway. So, you know, there are a lot of things you have to do to nurture what I'm talking about. But as for what you do about Iran now, well, I would apply the same general approach, which is to say that we have to go beyond saying, no, you can't have them, our friends can, even if they're violating international law. And we have to at least propose something a little more general and comprehensive to suggest to them that we respect the fact that that we're ultimately moving toward a general legal and normative regime.
So do you think that if we could persuade India, for instance, to come within all the strictures of the NPT, that this would persuade the Iranians to give up their nuclear weapon?
I think something that would be very interesting, I honestly don't know how this would work out, but I think if you don't hear it discussed much, but I've never heard a killer argument against it, and I've brought it up here before, if Israel said, okay, look, we have nuclear weapons, which everyone knows, we have them because we believe our history demonstrates unequivocally that we have a lot of people who would like for this country not to exist, We think it would be suicide to give them up now. We would like to work toward a day when there are no nuclear weapons in the Middle East. And as some sort of, out-of-the-gate gesture, we will, do X, Y, Z. For example, we will build no more, and we will open the reactor up to international inspection to prove we're not building more. We will even decommission 10 of whatever, a couple hundred nuclear warheads, set up a timetable. Of course, all of this is contingent on Iran opening up and saying, okay, we're on board. We will submit to these intrusive inspections and so on. I would be...
I don't think Iran would find that deal the slightest bit interesting.
I think, first of all, it would put pressure on the Iranian government.
You mean world opinion?
I mean the opinion of, you're going to say that Iran is impervious to world opinion, right?
Because let's really look at the world from their point of view, okay?
Yeah.
They think they have a vital national interest in protecting them against enemies, both real and potential. That the safest thing, if you want to be safe, you need to have a nuclear weapon. Now, this could be the result of any number of actions by us and by other powers, et cetera, and their history of the world as they see it. So why in the world, if the deal you're offering them is Israel gets to keep its 190 or however many it is, and they get to get one, they don't get to get one, why is that a good deal for them?
It could actually, I think, increase the stature of their leadership in the region in a lot of ways.
I just don't think
they were shown to be leading, because remember, I mean, from an Arab point of view and an Iranian, from a regional point of view, this would be considered a significant concession by Israel. I think for you to have instigated that kind of concession, if you're Iran, I think that might actually accrue to your benefit in terms of regional stature.
I think it's highly unlikely the Iranians would view it that way.
Well, it could be, but I'll tell you another thing, Bob. In terms of the things that you've agreed are important, things like amassing international support for truly effective sanctions against Iran, failing that, maximizing the international support for a military attack on Iran, I'm pretty sure that both of those would actually be facilitated by Israel first demonstrating that it's serious about solving this peacefully. And we have not seen that demonstration yet.
Okay, but you and I have a fundamentally different view of the way the world works, and which leads me not to agree that it would make a difference, since I don't believe that the reason we're having a hard time getting international support for dealing with Iran has anything to do with anyone's perception of what Israel's doing or what India's doing or any of that. I think in the case of Russia and China, they do not perceive it to be in their interest to be joining with the United States and Europe in giving Iran a hard time. On the contrary, I think they see great opportunities in this standoff. I think the Europeans are going to be reluctant to take any extreme action against Iran, regardless of what Israel does or doesn't do.
But you said that you had hopes that they would support military intervention if it came to that. And surely, wouldn't you agree that the more Israel seems to have gone out of its way to solve this peacefully, the more supportive they're going to be?
I think it would be very... It's possible that they would be a little more supportive. I think it would be very marginal.
Yeah. Well, the general principle... Okay, we're close to an hour. I mean, so let me say one or two things about my general position on this stuff and 9/11 generally. In general, my feeling about... Let me tell you what I think of the differences between you and me, and then I'll let you close by correcting me, okay?
Well, that's very generous of you.
Thanks. Well, it's the kind of guy, liberals are... this is why liberals always lose, is they're too nice.
Yeah.
I have thought for a long time that actually non-state actors in possession of nuclear and biological weapons are probably the biggest security threat we face in the long run. I thought that well before 9/11. Now, you have emphasized that much less before 9/11. I think in your kind of well-known paper that I guess you co-authored with Crystal, Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy, I think that kind of stuff got very little emphasis. So I think this is one difference between us. It is related to another one, which is that you see some alternative areas of focus in theoretical threats that I don't give as much credence to, like rising great powers. I tend to think that those problems can be, are relatively manageable, are not as dicey as this problem, like keeping China in check, okay?
Yeah.
So, as a result, I think, and I don't accept what it seems to me you're almost proposing in Iran, which is that, okay, so weapons of mass destruction are a problem. The way to keep them out of terrorist hands is every time a state starts to develop them, America bombs or America invades. As an American, I'm not willing to accept all the blowback and cost of that. I'm looking for a more comprehensive solution in terms of an international legal regime with actual teeth, intrusive inspections, and so on. And I think we should have been nurturing that for a long time. And I'm not willing to do these, you know, I'm not so eager to do these kind of ad hoc cowboy things. Wait, it seems like there was one more thing I was going to say before I shut up. There's a related thing that of course, also philosophically, I am more of a realist in terms of how you deal with these things, but that's, I mean, realist with a capital R, not in the terms of being more realistic in my view of the world, but...
Well, I actually think that you're less of a realist, but that's okay.
Right, and that's why I specified that I'm using that as a technical
term. I think you're less of a realist.
Oh, come on.
Well, because,
in the technical sense?
Yeah, because the realist, I mean, true realism, sort of hardcore realism, John Mearsheimer realism...
Well, he's a hyper-realist.
Okay, well, you're a... What's the opposite of a hyper-realist? I don't know.
Well, that would be a hypo-realist, but I'm just a realist. I'm Goldilocks.
Anyway, I think that the basic premise of realism is that the world tends toward... The entire system is essentially anarchic. And how nations respond to that, realists differ, you know, between neorealism, defensive realism, offensive realism, et cetera, et cetera. But the premise is that it's anarchic, and I think you see a lot more promise for world order, which quite honestly makes you, and I don't use terms in as insults the way you do, but I would say it makes you more of a Wilsonian. So anyway, on Iran, let me just say, and if the other thing comes to you, you know, you can jump in.
Okay.
My preferred option is in fact not a military action, but an attempt to see whether the current turmoil in Iran can be pushed so that you actually wind up with a different leadership, which I think is possible. It's certainly more possible than we ever imagined it before. I think that idea goes very much along with the Bob Wright view of the progressive view that kind of positive change can occur. And if there's any way we can assist that change, I would like to do so. And I think in a way I'd rather be doing that than obsessing about their nuclear weapon right now. Okay, that would be my near-term goal. I think that would have the more positive effect. I'm very skeptical about the non-proliferation regime moving in a positive direction, and I'm more skeptical now than I would have been 10 years ago, because you know, this great power, what I see is this emerging sort of great power competition, which does not concern you, actually ought to concern you, because I think it's an obstacle to making progress on a lot of these issues, including a lot of the so-called global issues. I think it's an obstacle to making progress on climate change. I think it's an obstacle to making progress on non-proliferation, because you really do have great powers with very differing interests who are less likely than before, even, to come together to find these kind of, you know, best solutions that are win-win for everybody. I think we're in a much more conflictive situation than that, and it's going to be harder to achieve the things you want to achieve.
Yeah, well, that could take us a lot.
Well, that would be another
places.
Conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, you know, in terms of what a realist is and isn't, if you read Hans Morgenthau's, what is it, Power Among Nations, is that one of his big...
Yeah.
He actually
I know, he winds up talking about the UN. It's a big cop-out, but...
Right. But, I mean, what he's implicitly acknowledging there when he says someday realism may imply world government,
yeah.
which he says, he's acknowledging that that realism doesn't posit that the world is a jungle. I mean, I think he's implicitly saying...
No, it does posit the world is a jungle. It's illogical within the context of his argument, but he offers a possible way out. But his basic principle is the only way to achieve justice, and this is the core realist principle, is through a balance of power and through restraint practiced by nations.
Well, I see a core of maybe the core of realism as A, the assumption that nations behave in their self-interest, and B, the assertion that your nation should in fact behave in its self-interest. I think if that is what, you know, in a pretty, in a somewhat pitiless and cool way, and if that is realism, then I would say the actual manifest growth in non-zero-sum dynamics among nations over the last century implies that, says that the implications of realism will change.
Boy, that's a great sentence you just uttered.
I think not.
The non-zero-sum,
I
really like
that. I think you're mocking
me.
I think you're mocking me.
No,
but,
I'm not. It was a very elegant sentence. I liked it.
You're too kind.
I don't believe it, but I like the sentence.
No, I don't. I wear your disbelief as a badge of honor, and I'll take your rhetorical compliment.
Good. I think that's win-win, Bob.
That is win-win. Can I make one piece of housekeeping announcement?
Yes.
We're starting this thing called the Apollo Project, where our commenters and other viewers will actually, in a special part of the site, be able to do what you and I are doing, Bob, you know, go head-to-head in video.
Lucky them.
Hey, Bob, we're trying to stir up enthusiasm
for
this.
I'm sincere.
You meant lucky them. As we know, neocons are without irony, so you must have meant what you said. Lucky them. And indeed they are. And anyway, I wanted to say the first one is scheduled to tape this Friday. People should continue, who are interested should continue to write in and tell us at, I think the email address is apollo@bloggingheads.tv. And we may occasionally, if we see a very fruitful, rich, and civil debate going on in our comment section.
Like the kind that we just had.
Such like that, except taking place in our comment section in print. I mean, we may suggest that they take it to video. I don't know. But anyway, thank you, Bob. Is there anything? I truly will give you the last word now if you want it, if there's anything else you want to say.
No, I'm very happy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, and we'll see you again.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.